You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 331, Spreadsheets and Politicians, we check out the list of sleaze. Terence and Juliet discuss the weirdness of the loan system in football and newspapers, rising costs, shrinking circulations, and that's not fake news. It's all coming up after Bob Marley and Jamming.
That was a huge hit in the UK in 1977. My girlfriend's mother used to say, "Oh, here's that song you like on the radio again, the German one." And we would hear her in the kitchen go, "Oh, we're German. German in the name of the Lord." From 1977, number nine on the UK Top 40, Bob Marley and the Wailers and Jamming.
And nine, of course, being German for no as well.
Exactly, yes, that's a good point.
She had a theory that she was a wise lady.
She may have been right on the ball there. Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 331. Who'd have thought? I'm Terence Stackham, and jamming with us all is Juliet Harris.
I do like jamming too, as it happens. Hello.
Jules, the songwriters of old used to tell us...
I'm familiar with their work, yeah.
Yeah, they used to tell us that love and marriage go together like a horse and carriage.
There's going to be a lot of you singing this week. Do we need to start warning
there may be a little bit more, yeah. But if Sammy Kahn was still with us and writing lyrics today, he'd be more likely to write, here we go again, politicians and spreadsheets go together like scandals and retweets.
Oh, very good. I thought you were going scandals and bedsheets for a minute, but that would work.
That would work just as well at the moment. Now, one doesn't really want to haul President Trump into this, but in this case of the spreadsheet of sleaze that we've all seen, I think there's a very real danger of this very serious matter being undermined by the addition of what can only be described as fake news, as Donald would say. That is, whilst there are some allegations that appear to have substance, mixed in amongst them on this spreadsheet are some names and stories that are nothing more than consenting adults forming relationships at the workplace. Some lasted, some didn't, but the key thing was that everybody was consenting and happy with the arrangement. Jules, you've got an insight into how and why these names and stories have emerged at this turbulent time.
Well, yes, indeed. Well, firstly, to pick up on your point, so in case for our sort of American people that we have or other people don't necessarily know, so there's quite a lot of scandals going on over here at the moment in our political pond. There's been some sort of allegations of sleaze, of sexual assault. Well, it's spun out from the Harvey Weinstein thing, hasn't it? Weinstein, however you want to say it. There's, as a result of that, there seems to be, and I think a long overdue, a sort of wholesale examination of how women are treated by men, power imbalances and that sort of thing, which has now sort of shone a light on Westminster, our parliament over here, and what happens there. This spreadsheet has been circulating, a little Excel number, with the names of about 40 Conservative politicians, only Conservative politicians at this stage, and various allegations against them. Now, as Terence, I mean, it's been floating about in all sorts of places. There is a heavily redacted version that was published by one of the papers, I think. There's an unredacted version in circulation, which we will be talking obliquely about for fairly obvious reasons. The first thing that you said, Terence, that I really agree with, but I'm going to sort of make it more serious, really, is the idea that the spreadsheet seems to be mixing serious allegations of sexual assault, and even if not sort of overt sexual assault, then general kind of inappropriate behaviour with junior members of staff. So, sort of perhaps touching researchers before asking them if they're okay with that and continuing even if it's obvious that they're not, and that sort of thing. To then sort of allege that people have had affairs and that sort of things in the same spreadsheet, I think, muddies the water because it detracts from the seriousness of the allegations, that the sexual assault allegations. So I don't like the idea that those very serious allegations, and women have come forward and talked about their experiences, and this is not just in the context of the spreadsheet, this is generally, and a Labour activist called Bex Bailey, who I know a little bit, has come forward and said that she was raped at a Labour Party event several years ago, and when she brought it up a couple of years later, she was pretty much advised by a senior official that if she wanted her career in the party to go anywhere, then she probably oughtn't to say anything, and so, which is just outrageous, really, if you think about it. So this spreadsheet, and I think the muddying of the waters here between the kind of the genuine sort of, as you say, the genuine assaults, and the assaults, and then the kind of consenting affairs between adults. There's one particular MP that appears to have been, how can we put this, quite busy. if we include that, I think the reason that is being kind of muddied in this is trying to be painted as a sort of a sleaze scandal. It almost feels like, I think the journalist Helen Lewis said the other day on another podcast that she's been prompted to spend half an hour reading the Back to Basics Wikipedia entry, because this is starting to sound a bit sort of early 90s. I thought I'd have a look at the spreadsheet, because the thing that struck me was at the time when we were making, I mean, life seems to have moved so fast in the last few days, at the time when we were making the sort of the podcast menu earlier in the week, since then Michael Fallon, the then defense secretary, has resigned due to various different allegations, and there are also increasingly serious allegations against Damian Green, who's the sort of deputy prime minister. I wanted to have a look at the spreadsheet and do a bit of analysis. We all know how I love to do a bit of nerdy crunching, because it struck me like Damian Green and Michael Fallon, they backed Remain. at the referendum. And so I was starting to feel that large amounts of our press, who leaned perhaps towards the right, one might say, backed Brexit at the referendum. And so I've had increasing concerns about the way in which people that were on the Brexit side are starting to make what I feel a very, having talked about wanting to take back parliamentary sovereignty from Europe, those people are very unkeen to give Parliament any sovereignty at the moment. They don't like the idea of things being voted on, for example. This Conservative government has this new novel practice of not turning up to opposition day debates, where so Labour win them all 300-0 at the moment, but then they don't actually do anything about it. The government do anything about that, which, and I think John Bercow is making increasingly overt statements as to how this isn't really very acceptable. The leader of the House of Commons is Andrea Leadsom, who has made, I think, some rather worrying statements about how any criticism, any factual reporting of economic difficulties as a result of Brexit is starting to be called treason and treacherous and traitorous, which I find really alarming. So I wanted to have a look at the people on the spreadsheet. We won't name them, but I wanted to have a look at them and see how they broke down in the sense of remain and leave. And I calculated, I got on the how did your MP vote in the referendum website.
Gosh, you have done a lot of work.
I know, exactly. Mm. It didn't take very long, really. Mm. I was waiting to find out where my car was in boring scenes from my life, which we won't talk about this week. No. But I worked out that 24 people on the spreadsheet backed remain and 16 backed leave, which when I fed it into the computer, we came out as 60% remain and 40% leave. So it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be, and it is reasonably reflective of the how Parliament, you know, how MPs voted, if not how the public voted. But I am concerned by the tone of this kind of, I mean, I think it's outrageous. I think the scandals in Parliament, I think that it shows that there is a structural problem in Parliament with women and how women are treated and power imbalances on all sides. And I am really pleased if this will, if all of these things, if Weinstein, if all of these things will result in a complete change in how and what behaviour is deemed acceptable in the workplace, in workplace attitudes and how women are treated. I really, really want this to be changed. I hope that all the pain that has been caused that can at least, you know, and by pain that's been caused, I don't mean to people who have been caught out. I mean to people who have suffered this abuse for years and who have been forced into this culture of silence. I mean, there are female journalists that text each other to tell them which men they shouldn't be getting in the back of taxis with because they are a bit, you know, a bit friendly. And that is just, I think, completely unacceptable. But what worries me is how the tenor of the reporting on this and the people that are being gone after and the way in which there are sort of splashes that are being made. I am concerned by the attitudes that want to back Brexit at all costs, that the elements that are kind of saying, oh well, this will of the people thing, it's starting to have, I think, uncomfortable parallels with other periods in history. And another thing which I think is interesting, and it's kind of making me want to sort of, it's making me feel like a bad feminist at times, it's now been revealed that Michael Fallon, at first no one seemed to understand why he apparently resigned, because he had apparently touched Julia Hartley Brewer's knee about 20 years
ago. We all knew there was something more to this.
And now it's been widely reported in the press that it would seem that he went because Andrea Leadsom had complained that he had behaved in an inappropriate way towards her. And by inappropriate, I mean that he had made some suggested comment about how she could warm her hands up, and because she complained of being cold, and also put an arm around her and had behaved in, I think, a slightly creepy and an unwanted way. She should not have had to put up with that. No woman should have to put up with that. But that's how I feel. Having said that, though, the nature of Andrea Leadsom has been one of the fiercest sort of stop talking down Britain because you don't want us to make this decision. She has been using some very, I think, alarming language in terms of sort of this sort of enemies of the people type thing. And I, you know, I am uncomfortable with that, and I'm comfortable with how certain elements who I think have, you know, certain elements on the right who I think have no respect for women at all and have you know, are using this as a convenient smoke screen under which to kind of, you know, perhaps move us towards their direction. I hope we do not end up with the perfect gentleman that is Jacob Rees-Mogg as PM as a result of this. I am uncomfortable with the way that this is being used. I hope not as a smokescreen for a more authoritarian direction.
In terms of Fallon, of course, also it's emerged today that Jane Merrick, the writer for the Observer and The Guardian, also, and Fallon has accepted this, that he lunged at her and tried to press his lips to hers.
And she has told this story. I've heard her tell
She's told it without naming Fallon before.
And she has told this several times over several years, and the story has never changed. No. So I think that it is
I correct. Think he said today that he accepts it, and that's one of the reasons. Of course, each of these allegations is awful, as you rightly said, for those that have been attacked by men wielding varying levels of power. And to date...
And also for men that have been attacked by men as well, because there have been some of those allegations too.
And the main platforms have been the entertainment industry, perhaps starting most notably, as you said, with Weinstein a few weeks ago. Yeah. Politicians and sports, with ongoing inquiries, particularly related to football. But there's a feeling, I don't know if I'm alone in this, but maybe I'm sure you'll be able to tell me, that we're only learning of the very tip of the iceberg, and the sort of behaviour we're now hearing about has been endemic in all different aspects of society for generations. Indeed, women have been exploited since the dawn of time, and we're at a stage... so often in these breaking stories of being unable to speculate what the next breaking news will be. But what we do know is that each individual assault or abuse of power has meant terrible consequences in terms of stress, pain and anger, as you say, for the victims. But where I'm perhaps a little bit more sceptical than you, that we're approaching change. I hope I'm wrong, and that some men begin to view the world in a different way, respecting women and treating women as equals, and junior men, as you say. But I'm wondering, is that too much to hope for?
Well, absolutely. And I, like you, I really hope this is going to change everything. But I am trying to be mindful of the fact at the same time that this, what I hope is going to make a better world, is not going to be exploited by others that do not want to make a better world. And as we are on air, now the second Conservative whip, Chris Pincher, has just quit his job in the whip's office and referred himself to the police. There was a large story in the Daily Mail today about him behaving inappropriately towards various people, including a former Olympic rower and a Labour male MP.
Just as we were just saying, you don't know what the next breaking news is going to be.
So, I mean, it's... Someone said to me the other day, do you think this will bring the government down? And I keep saying I think stuff will bring the government down, and then it doesn't. I think that the thing that concerns me about... there's been a lot of kind of old Theresa May. This is not Theresa May's fault, in the sense that this is a structural problem, and this could not be clearer. It's not just, it's not just based on the Conservatives. There have been some issues with Labour as well. This was all first sparked, actually, by Jared O'Mara, the Labour MP. That was the first sign, and then there's been Kelvin Hopkins as well. I think there are questions as to how the leaders of both parties have dealt with this. Jeremy Corbyn's office were apparently made aware of this allegation. They claim that they weren't aware of the full severity of allegations against Kelvin Hopkins, but they were aware of allegations and then promoted him to the shadow cabinet. And Corbyn has actually been interviewed by the BBC saying that he didn't see how this was inappropriate, which just makes me want to run into a wall, frankly. But Theresa May has been going down the line of, when told about these sort of allegations, we're investigating them under the ministerial code. And you feel like saying, why is this a ministerial code issue? Why is just this not this isn't acceptable? Don't you think it's time you resigned type issue to these people? So I'm finding Theresa May's complete lack of leadership to be... And this is why I am so concerned about making these kind of noises about this sort of, worries about authoritarian swings, because it is very obvious that we have a government and a prime minister that is not really in control at the moment. It feels like that a little bit, like she's not. I mean, she decided, not making good decisions, she decided that the best thing to do in the circumstances when Michael Fallon resigned was to replace him with Gavin Williamson, who happens to be the chief whip. And there's lots of feeling in the Conservative Party that he's 1950s, you know, there's been comparisons made to Francis Urquhart from from House of Cards, that he's managed to manoeuvre himself into the job that he wanted. Jess Phillips MP making the excellent point today that it would have made far better sense to make Anne Milton chief whip, a woman and someone that is well respected. And I think Robert Pester made that point too. But yes, I'm not enjoying, whilst, you know, I hope that all of these people are brought to justice and that we suddenly, you know, the men start to realise this is not okay. And it's unfortunate, in order for men to realise this is not okay, they have to lose their livelihoods. But if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. But I'm just concerned. I hope that this isn't sort of used as a way to kind of swing us in a more authoritarian direction by other forces.
Okay. Now, coming next, the loan system in football. It's a very peculiar business. How many players has your team got farmed out? We'll be looking at that right after Pavement.
Blind date with the chancer, we had oysters and dry lancers, and the check when it arrived, we went Dutch, 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 Dutch. A redder shade of neck on a whiter shade of trash, and this hammering board is giving me a rash. I'm flat out, you're so beautiful to look at when you cry. Freeze, don't move, you've been chosen.
This is the sort of music that when I used to play, my mum used to come in and say, every time I played Pavement, she'd come in and say, I know that we don't have the same taste. And there's not many of your records that I would say are completely tuneless, but, and that was always what she used to say whenever any Pavement record was played. And I can see her point on this, because there's a sort of bit as before it goes into the chorus where the kind of, oh my God, bit where it's just, it's not so much a tune as a kind of some notes sliding down a hill. But having said that, I enormously enjoy Pavement. I think they're great. They are one of the original Slackerama bands, and I enjoy their music very much, and that I often find myself cheerily whistling Pavement, and I found myself whistling that this week. So that's Shady Lane by Pavement.
Pavement, of course, from Stockton, California, a city we mentioned last week. Maybe
it's almost like plan this.
Yeah, maybe they'll benefit from that basic income initiative if times get hard for the Pavement.
At which point I'm sure my mum would say, well, they might be more likely to make money from that than they might be their songwriting. I'm not sure.
A couple of days ago, the England football manager Gareth Southgate named his squad for the pointless and unwanted international friendlies.
I'm enjoying editorial.
Editorializing here.
We're not at all, but bringing our own viewpoint into this.
they're in about a week's time, two over a few days. They're against Germany and Brazil. Of course, these games send fear through managers and supporters of league teams, as there's always a striker or key midfield general who returns to his club with his foot in plaster. But anyway, named in the England squad this week, Tammy Abraham and Ruben Loftus-Cheek, both contracted to Chelsea, but both not deemed ready for football, Premier League football at Chelsea, as both have been loaned out to other clubs. Now, speaking of Chelsea, after John Terry left in the summer, you may be interested to know who is now Chelsea's longest-serving player.
I would like to know that.
I thought it was going to be on the tip of your tongue. Step forward, 25-year-old goalkeeper Mate Delac, who signed for Chelsea in 2009, 8-plus years ago. And now, you know, you might ask, who? With some justification. He's never played one single minute for Chelsea. For the last 8 years, he's been out on loan to 8 different clubs, from Portugal to Belgium to Serbia to Bosnia, Croatia, France. He's certainly seeing a lot of Europe, a sort of anti-Brexit kind of move there.
I was going to say, if anyone's looking for a chap, you know, marry him and claim the air miles, frankly. You'll go to amazing places, won't you?
Now, Jules, perhaps there is some merit in a young player gaining some experience at a club, a division or two down, perhaps for 1 year, then returning to his parent club. But this whole loan system, particularly when lending players to clubs in your own division, or sending players out for up to 8 years in young Master Delac's case, this has got to be stopped.
I think so, yeah. And I was briefed by you this week that your very own club, your Chelsea, currently have 38 players out on loan. They have 3.5 teams out on loan. It's completely out of control. It's like you say, we get to this situation where really good players end up completely screwing their careers. Players like Sterling, for example, and Scott Sinclair, I think of as well, the Chelsea chap, who was tipped to be a big kind of England player. And these players, they go off to Chelsea or Manchester City or Liverpool, say, and they don't really play, these young players. They get sent out on loan. And actually, yes, I think it is good experience. Can they do it on a wet Tuesday night in Stoke phrase, I think, applies here. I think that if you're not playing regularly for your club, then getting whacked about a bit at Port Vale is probably quite character building, I think, or, you know, making to go running into a key or wherever it is that you're sent to do. But it gets to the point where it's not serving anybody. It's not serving the players. It's not serving the England team. And I think all the time that this system goes on, this is why England are not going to really go anywhere. You've got these young players that are playing, as you say, the players you mentioned, Tammy Abraham and the other chap,
Ruben Loftus-Cheek.
Yeah, that's right. They are good enough to play for the England youth teams, but they're not good enough to play for their parent clubs. So then, if these players are not getting experience at the top level, not just not getting the top experience, getting experience at the top level, if they're not getting experience at any level at all, if they are literally sat bench warming, or, you know, they're playing at a lower level at Charlton for a bit or whatever, you know, we need to stop pretending, and this feels relevant politically at the moment, we need to stop pretending we're still one of the greatest forces in the world when it's quite clear that we're not, are we? If we're not producing the players that enable us to win tournaments, and if we're still sort of judging our success by the national team, which the FA and the tabloid press seem obsessive about doing, then I think we're in a situation where I mean, even my team, QPR, who, let's face it, as much as I love them, we're not anyone really, are we, particularly?
Not the moment, no.
We're in the Championship. We really were one of these teams that would benefit from my Premier League and a half, which sort of 6 of us, Norwich and Birmingham and us and Newcastle, can sit in this kind of transition league and play each other every year. I think that would make my life a lot happier. But we have 5 players out on loan. Why have we got 5 players out on loan? What are we doing? You know, why don't I find it very peculiar, like you say. I think that it's bad for them. It's bad for the English game to be not producing these players at a high level. And it is just sheer greed on part of the teams like Chelsea. I think it's greed, and I think it's It's not fair play. It's bending the rules by exploiting the fact that they have a lot more money than even other teams like Manchester United or Arsenal particularly. So they just, you know, they stockpile all of these players. They've got the EU butter mountain equivalent of all these kind of all these players that are kind of, I presume, piled up in some sort of store cupboard somewhere, and occasionally all in sort of frozen or behind glass. And occasionally, if Oscar goes over and can't get up again, Chelsea go into the back room and whack the wall with a hammer and pop one out for a few weeks. But or they put in a call to Morecambe and say it's time for the goalkeeper to come back. I don't know, but I find it, you know, I find it symptomatic of one of the sicknesses of the modern game that you have. It's the 99% versus the 1%, isn't it? That you've got clubs that have disproportionate. I mean, the telly money was meant to make life a bit, you know, make life a bit more equal in this respect. And yes, we've talked at the beginning of the season about how every team have now bought up, you know, they're able to buy proper players, but I am uncomfortable with the idea that the big teams like Chelsea and Manchester City can afford to starve smaller teams of players and then ration them out depending on whether it's convenient for Chelsea or Manchester City. It sticks in my craw a bit.
I undertook some research on this, and I say those words from time to time, and I immediately imagine every listener hitting the fast forward button as I say I undertook some research. I looked at every Premiership club and how many players they have on loan. Don't worry, I'm not going to go through them all.
I don't mind hearing about that at all. And I would point out to iTunes this is that you can fast forward in 15-second chunks.
Exactly. Feel free. I looked at every Premiership club and how many players they've got out on loan. Most only have that handful, as I say. Those with the fewest, with only three players out on loan, are Crystal Palace, Everton, Stoke and Tottenham. Three, yes. You know, OK. All the others have less than 10 players out on loan, with three clubs as exceptions. Perhaps surprisingly, Burnley have 13 players out on loan.
That's,
13.
That is quite surprising.
That is absolutely bizarre, because they are a sort of similar level, you would think, financially, I'm assuming, to sort of your QPR. So how they can afford to be paying 13 players that are out on loan?
I think they've been in the Premier League for longer than us, so I think they're probably better off. I think the comparison to Crystal Palace is probably more apt. I think that's quite strange.
Burnley with 13. Manchester City have 14. But then Chelsea, my Chelsea, as you said earlier, with a whopping. So the second highest has 14, Man City. Chelsea, 38 players.
But you have more than the next two down put together.
It's just crazy. They're under contract but loaned out. And I was looking, they're loaned out to other clubs all around the world. But here's the thing. This is the thing I think is perhaps the key part of this for me anyway. Five of that 38 are loaned out to other Premiership clubs. And crucially, aren't eligible to play against Chelsea, their parent team. So it's an argument that Chelsea will play 10 games, five teams home and away, this season against weakened teams, because Tammy Abraham can't play for Swansea against Chelsea. Ruben Loftus-Cheek can't play for Crystal Palace against Chelsea. And for that reason alone, teams shouldn't be allowed to lend players to clubs in the same division.
Yes, I agree. I didn't realise, because I knew that players used to get cup tied, didn't they? They couldn't play for another team
once they played
moved
in that competition.
Yeah. But I hadn't realised that was a thing. And I think that is spectacularly mean-spirited, that, you know, you can't...
By the way, that's an FA law. That's not Chelsea's law. That's all clubs.
But yes, OK, fair enough. Well, I take that bit back then. But I do think that... Like you say, it does seem to show a lack of foresight, and yes, it's the FA's decision, but I wonder who lobbied for that and how much pressure they were put under by who.
Well, I suppose the thinking is that if, obviously I'm not going to name a player, I guess it would be awful, but if player A goes out on loan to another club and then is allowed to play against Chelsea, he might feel he can't put his all into it so that's possibly it. Or
although
at least
I'd
it's
have to say, if I was a Chelsea player that had been
made
to spend 8 months of my life in Ipswich when I didn't want to, no offence Ipswich, I would very much want to go out and absolutely stick it to them, frankly. I see that. It's kind of conflicts of interest, isn't it, really? But yeah, I do feel that I'm fed up with the big clubs like your Chelsea. Riding roughshod over everyone else, really.
Yeah, no, it just doesn't feel right. And 38, I just can't understand how anybody in the structure at Chelsea.
If they've got 38 players out on loan,
how can you keep tabs on them?
And also, yeah, exactly. Presumably they have a department just for that, I guess.
Yeah, they do.
And also, if they've still got a core squad of 26, 27, that means they must have 60-odd registered players then.
Absolutely. It's just extraordinary. And, of course, I suppose, in a sense, the worst aspect for those 38 is that probably 35 of them will never play a first-team game. Mm. They'll slowly but sure their contracts will be run down and then they'll be let go for free or for some nominal sum.
Yeah, and then they find themselves at Gillingham at the age of 24, wondering what happened to their lives.
Absolutely. The cost of buying newspapers, and I suppose magazines, it keeps going up and up, but circulations keep going down and down. Mm. Now, the death of print media has been predicted for nearly 20 years now in the age of the internet, but are we really getting close to that final nail in the coffin now? That's next after this gorgeous track from Paul McCartney.
Late at night when the wind is still, I'll come flying through your door. And you'll know what love is for. I'm a bluebird, I'm a bluebird, I'm a bluebird, I'm a bluebird. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm a bluebird, I'm a bluebird, I'm a bluebird. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Touch your lips with a magic kiss, and you'll be a bluebird too. And you'll know what love can do. I'm a bluebird, I'm a bluebird, I'm a bluebird. I'm a bluebird, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm a bluebird, I'm a bluebird, I'm a bluebird.
Overlooked when tracks from Band on the Run are played. Radio stations, they usually favour the title track or Jet. And although much of Band on the Run was recorded in rather peculiar circumstances in Lagos in Nigeria, this track was recorded later in London from the Ace album Band on the Run, the magnificently snuggly Bluebird by Paul McCartney and Wings.
I think that's lovely, and I agree with you. And I do feel that weirdly, Band on the Run is a... I don't know how I can say it as an overlooked album where so many people bought it. But yeah, like you say, there's such a dependence on the big kind of radio hits. But, you know, there's not a bad song on there, I don't think.
I agree. Very consistent album. So terrific. Yeah. The fall of the House of Newsprint has been predicted pretty much since the late 1990s, when most newspapers rushed to put their content on the new super cool internet for free. And then, much to their shock, these newspapers then found out that inexplicably their readers, now able to read that content for free, were ever more reluctant to then also spend ever increasing amounts for the daily paper edition. This week, the Daily Telegraph very quietly increased the cost of buying the weekday edition to £1.80. That was up 20 pence in one hit. That still puts it behind your The Guardian, which charges £2 for its weekday edition for content that is all available for free online. We talked a couple of years ago, Jules, about how the end for daily newspapers was a-coming. They're still hanging on in there, but with dwindling circulations, thinner content, and astronomic pricing. Surely we're close to the end of daily newspapers now.
Well, we might be close to the end of daily newspapers in terms of hard copy content. I was horrified. I'd spent much of this weekend at my local hospital with a family relative that wasn't very well. So I shuffled off to the shop to get a paper at one point. And the advantage of newspapers is that, as you say, the cover price is the price. It doesn't vary from shop to shop. You pay the amount. So I said to someone, "Oh, well, you know, weren't the shop expensive?" And they said, "Yeah, but the price of the newspaper is the price of the newspaper, isn't it?" Okay, fine. So I went downstairs to buy a weekend Guardian and found myself parting with £2.90 in order to do so.
Grief. Good
most,
grief.
Most of the contents of which are up online, exactly, as you say. And in the past, when you used to shell out, or if I used to buy an Observer, which is the Sunday edition, which is a similar-ish price, I used to think, yeah, well, I am shelling out. But, you know, you get all the magazines. And the Guardian, the Observer, used to do these monthly pullouts. They did the food monthly, the sport monthly, and the music monthly. And I think there was a film monthly as well. And you felt that you were actually genuinely getting, you know, some special things. And, you know, or there might be, you know, a special pullout for some reason. I bought the Guardian yesterday. There was, as I could see, and I don't mean this, you know, to anybody that's listening that toils away producing weekend editions, I could not see there was anything particularly quote unquote special about it, or that it was the ordinary supplements. And I resented paying £2.90 for it, frankly. And I do think that the days of buying hard copy newspapers are, I think, perhaps coming to an end. I consume increasing amounts of my news online. I don't subscribe to the Telegraph. I think I'm on their premium service, so I'm allowed to read a certain amount of articles free. I do subscribe to the Times, and I do enjoy being able to read the Times columns in the red box and that sort of thing. I wonder if newspapers, and I think we might have come to this conclusion previously, but the daily newspapers won't cease to exist as such, because it would seem that people are willing to pay for paywalls. And actually the Times and the Telegraph, the paywall people, find themselves actually doing reasonably well, I think, and that seems to be a model that allows them to sustain themselves. I don't think newspapers as producers of news were, and you know, actually lots of, you know, it was the Telegraph that broke the expenses scandal. I mean, I know I've talked about my concerns over Brexit and the bias of the press earlier, but, you know, again, they were, you know, I it's not that I don't believe in news reporting, because I very much do, and I think we've seen the limitations of fake news and the idea, these kind of new, my comrades on the left, these new sort of left-wing firebrands, which is basically one guy producing news in his room. And by I mean producing news, I mean writing about stuff and putting it on the internet. There is no second source fact checking that goes on here. We were laughing the other day about someone said, "Oh, did you know that Squawk Box's constituency Labour Party have just elected some moderate representatives?" And I said, "Hang on, is Squawk Box one bloke then?" It turns out there is. He's not actually called Mr. Squawk. Squawk Box, which was, you know, would have been excellent. But no, it is essentially a sort of a one man band. There's been some expose. There was a long Marie Leconte article on BuzzFeed about the canary and how it's basically a sort of a clickbait factory type thing. And you get paid if you put right for the canary. The extent to which you get paid depends upon how many view your articles. So that, you know, does not suggest integrity of news. Or rather, even if you start off as a journalist with integrity, if you've got a mortgage to pay, you know, I don't think that's right. So I think that the era that we're living in, and, you know, this idea of fake news, the increasingly questionable influence of Russia over world affairs, you know, Donald Trump's churning out of nonsense at 3 o'clock in the morning on Twitter. Shout out, by the way, to the Twitter employee on their last day whose last act was to disable Trump's Twitter account. That was, you know, I hope that person never has to buy another drink in their life. But so I think as we move towards a world of fake news, I hope that we all continue to value even more, you know, independent, you know, sort of properly sourced, responsibly reported news publications. I think that people will continue to consume them, but I do think that the future is online rather than hard copy newspapers.
Do you know what? You were mentioning Your Guardian there, and I thought I'd just do a quick calculation. £2.90 for the Saturday edition. I've just checked. It's £2.90 for the Observer on the Sunday.
Yeah, fair enough.
£2 for the Monday to Friday edition. So if you bought The Guardian through the week, and then the weekend, The Guardian Saturday and The Observer on Sunday. That's £15.80 a week. So over 52 weeks of a year, if one bought all of those, you'd be spending £821.60.
Wow, that's a lot of money, isn't it?
Which is, when you put it in that context, it just, for stuff that you can get for free online.
And now, I think that's the kicker, isn't it, really?
It really is. There are some strange anomalies throughout the UK daily newspaper industry. We tend to think, especially I'm afraid down here in the South, that it's all about the papers based in the South. And, you know, it was really funny. I was, again, doing some research. I was looking around the country and came across the Huddersfield Examiner in Yorkshire, of course, which not only publishes daily from Monday to Saturday, but also manages daily two separate regional editions in Huddersfield.
Oh, gosh. I had no idea Huddersfield was so rich.
Me too. They do a Brighouse and Elland edition and a North Kirklees edition. And about 1 in 10 people who live in Huddersfield buy the paper in its paper form every day. And that really did put a spanner in my theory that it's all over. But I suppose the only question to ask Trinity Mirror, who owned the Huddersfield Examiner, is whether they're actually making a profit on the Huddersfield Examiner. You know, that's possibly another story. It's only 75 pence a day for a copy. But it does show that there is actually a different world out there. But clearly, people in Huddersfield are very attached to their Huddersfield Examiner, and the people in North Kirklees and Brighouse and Elland, more so. Yeah. But there must be a definite tipping point where the content of the print editions thin out so much, balanced with these price hikes, where a sizable number of people, and I think I'm pretty close to it now, just think, it's just not for me now. You know, it feels like that day is ever closer.
Yeah, and actually interesting what you say about the local newspapers. Mm. And of course, there used to be, I mean, the Eastern Daily Press that exists up in East Anglia. I mean, there's been issues. I don't think even, you know, there's been problems with the Evening Argus down in Brighton. But I do think there may be people want to consume local news. Maybe there's more, as news reporting moves on, maybe there is a market still for local news reporting. I would like to see good quality sourced local papers. And of course, that might then serve to make the national papers more diverse again. And there was a publication recently of I think a Mr. Squawk Box type person that had a rich sense of indignation, published a thing online showing how many of the Guardian journalists went to various Oxbridge colleges. And I wonder if that has been heightened by the decline of local newspapers and how local news networks, and how in the olden days you'd start off as a cub reporter on the South End Echo or whatever, doing, you know, the court beat. And I remember a friend of mine being told once when she worked at a local paper somewhere that she'd know she'd made it when she had to report about Dogmark. And I can still remember her excitedly texting me one day saying, it's happened, look. And she wrote to me the next day with she'd done an article musical, and it had someone outraged holding a carrier bag with dog poo in it outside a park, and she was delighted that she finally made it. But in all seriousness, I think now, I hope that if local news can survive and begin to thrive again, then maybe that will mean that you know, anyone starting out can get a job on their local paper without necessarily having to have a degree or the contacts book that going to Oxbridge gives you, and you can work your way up again. And I like the idea of that world existing again, so here's hoping.
It must vary throughout the country, because in Berkshire and Surrey, all the local papers have gone. They've got an online presence where it's pretty low scale, and the number of journalists are now literally a handful on these. The Surrey Herald, where I think my first ever piece was published wrote was in the Surrey Herald. Long gone now, you know, maybe about 5 years. So you know, and the local editions that we used to have, like the Ashford and Egham News and all this, they're all long gone.
Although I would make one point about Dunstan Press, actually, just thinking about that. So we have the Hastings Observer down here, and there's a network. There's a Hastings Observer, the Battle Observer, and the Rye Observer, I think, and they are owned by Dunstan Press. As lots of the local, you mentioned the Huddersfield earlier, that's owned by Dunstan Press.
Jules, they're owned by Trinity Mirror.
But I still think the point of Johnston Press remains the same, because I own a number of local newspapers across the country. So having just praised local news, which I very much do, I think the point about impartiality needs to be made, because in the 2015 general election, in the run-up to it, and I think they did a similar thing this time round, they purchased a wraparound advert for local newspapers, the print editions, including the Hastings edition, that advertised the Conservative Party. The Conservatives bought a wraparound, which meant when you bought the Hastings Observer, there was, you know, a thing praising Amber Rudd and Conservatives on the front. And the words, "This is an advert," did not, I feel, have particular prominence. And then you took the wraparound off, and then the actual paper was inside. And I think that is, like we talked about fake news and bias and muddling of facts, I find that to be extremely concerning. They did that with, you know, various publications across the country. It wasn't just in Hastings.
No.
And yes, I do think that local press and having a strong local press and strong connection in the local community is very important. But I think if you're then going to sell advertising, and it was talked of as a way of kind of making them financially viable, if you're selling advertising for a political party that is then made to look like it is the front page of your newspaper, I think that's wrong.
Now, the thing is, Jules, your content is always entertaining and great value. Where might we find you over the coming week?
Well, as I've spent the last few days not quite knowing where I am at any given moment, I'm not entirely sure. You know, it may change at the time of going to press. I had an excellent time just gone. We put on a couple of bands. Me and my DJ partner, Letty put on a couple of bands. The Atom Jacks, very nice young chaps from Chichester. It was only their second ever gig, apparently. They were very good. And also a French band called The Soap Opera, who were excellent. You should definitely try and dig out some of their stuff. They're really good. I'm hoping to be back with Indie Wonderland this Wednesday on the radio from barricaderadio.com. It's 2 hours of indie alt rock and miscellaneous, having a bit of chat with people. And I am also I am DJing the Hastings and District Law Society Christmas free Christmas party on Friday evening, so should you find yourself there, please do give me a wave. And I will be, I suspect, around and about in Hastings this coming weekend. It's Saturday Social. It was meant to take place this weekend and didn't. It will either come back this Saturday, or I might just sit and wait it out and it will come back this Saturday afterwards.
Don't forget, if you would like to know immediately when the next podcast is available.
If you cannot wait.
The thing to do is to subscribe.
Indeed. On iTunes. Or your local friendly podcast provider.
Absolutely. Thanks to executive producer Rona, and playing us out, Jules, an artist with quite an extraordinary backstory.
Yeah, he's a very interesting chap. Also a chap that I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce, so I completely apologise if I have got this wrong. I'm going to call him William Onyebor. He was described, I do like Wikipedia's kind of straight-laced descriptions. William Onyebor, he died in January of this year, was a Nigerian funk musician and businessman. I quite like the idea of being a funk businessman. He was sort of, his music was kind of known in Nigeria in the late 70s and early 80s, but he was quite sort of a private, reclusive figure, really. He was on had some stuff released on the Luwaka Bop label. He seems to have sort of ended up there was a compilation called Who is William Onyebor that came out in 2013, which is how I first came across him, really. It came out on Luarkabot, which is David Byrne's label. And it kind of brought him to prominence, really. And I was sorry he died earlier in the year because I love his music. On Record Store Day earlier this year, I bought a record by somebody called the Atomic Bomb Band, which is basically a put-together band to cover William Onyebor songs. Some of Hot Chip, I think, were in them, amongst other people. And if you can get your hands on a copy of that, it is fantastic. And I'm going to use that word appropriately because I wanted to play their version of this tune, but as I could only find the William Onyebor version online, it's probably just as well, really, that we play his version of his tune. I do like a bit of Nigerian funk if I can get it into my life. So this is William Onyebor and Fantastic Man.
You have been listening to a DACA Media production.